morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm David Rifkin on behalf of the state of Texas. In the Sipcoal case, Texas and 12 other states were given two unpalatable choices by EPA. Suffer construction moratorium within 30 days of a rule's finalization, a state of play which both threatened states' economy and also threatened to vitiate states' permitting authority, to which they were entitled under the EPA-approved implementation plan, or agree under duress to submit a SIP modification on a 21-day timeline, inevitably fail to do so, have EPA come in, promulgate a FIP. Not much of a choice, Your Honor. This EPA conduct presents two distinct problems. First, it violates carefully cabined EPA's ability to implement, to prompt states to modify their SIPs under Section 110 of the Clean Air Act. These provisions reflect Congress's both considered policy judgments as to how this cooperative federalism program ought to be implemented, and also reflect their proper recognition of vertical separation of power requirements. Second, it vitiates Constitution's federalism structure, which prohibits EPA from putting a gun to the head of the states. Respect to the constitutional problem, this...
Mr. Rifkin, what's your response to... What's your response to EPA's argument that that the Clean Air Act itself, sections 165 and 167, that they operated to impose a requirement that there be no construction without greenhouse gas compliant permits? In other words, their position is that that the awkward position the states were in was a result of the statute itself, and that all their actions were aimed at ameliorating that problem to the extent they could.
To answer Judge Stadel, first of all, their parsing, which indeed is the plain language of Section 165. Section 165, of course, talks about what sources are supposed to do once a given pollutant has been brought into the ambit of a PSD program. They're totally ignoring an equally palpable language of Section 110. Section 165 says nothing about SIPs. Section 110 is a carefully created statutory architecture to deal with how EPA may prompt states to amend SIPs.
I understand that argument, but you agree that 165 and particularly 167 are very clear. And we have several cases, most recently Coalition, right, which, and Spencer and Alabama Power, which, all of which, we have this court saying these provisions are clear and unequivocal.
There are, Your Honor, but there's a great deal of case law in this and other circuits, including Arizona D.C. versus Brown, which talks about how you parse the plain meaning of a particular section in a way that makes sense of overall statutory scheme.
Why don't you look at the language of 167? Where is an ambiguity in that language that would allow us, you know, to depart from what we've said about this? It says that EPA shall take such measures to prevent the construction of a major emitting source which does not conform to the requirements of this part. See, it doesn't say this of regulations or of SIPs. It says this part.
I understand, Your Honor. Yeah. If you look at the equally compelling language of Section 110, 110I, if I may, that specifically prohibits both a state and EPA from modifying any provision of a SIP that affects a stationary source, then you got cases...
That relates to SIPs.
Yes, but right? What EPA threatened to do with construction moratorium, in fact, in our view, Section 110I functions as a kind of a SIP shield that prohibits for the duration of an approved SIP until EPA causes the state to change in accordance with other provisions, primarily 110A. We do not believe that 110K5 was properly invoked here. It prohibits both states and EPA from modifying that provision. That is the only way to harmonize those two provisions. But we also have, and of course we have instances, including Spencer County, that you mentioned, that try to reconcile two equally palpable and plain provisions, 165 and 168. And of course you remember how they were reconciled. There was a substantial delay in effectuating the requirements of Section 165.
Of course, those two sections were in direct conflict with each other. You could read the provisions you're citing as relating to SIPs, whereas 165 and 167 deal with sources.
But SIPs are very important, Your Honor. I've done a little bit of a search. Out of a 70 provisions in Title I, 47 talk about SIPs. There's clear case law in both this and in cases out of a Third Circuit, like the Concerned Citizens of Riceburg, which said that EPA does not have unlimited revisory authority to modify SIPs. They're entirely confined by what Congress gave them in Section 110. And if you look at the specific provisions of Section 110, what EPA done under K-5 makes no sense. It reads 110I out of existence. But if I may briefly press my constitutional point, under the canon of constitutional avoidance, if you are going to read what EPA has done here, we have a clear situation of coercion. Coercion in cases ranging from Bond to New York and Princeton, most recently NFIB. The Supreme Court has clearly ruled that if you're presenting the state with two coercive choices, two choices are equally not viable, you are creating a prohibited coercion. And if you were to read the language of a statute the way EPA is suggesting, you would have inevitable coercion. Now, the reason you don't have coercion when EPA proceeds under the proper procedures, we believe in this case under 110A2, is because it gives states a substantial amount of time to ponder their choices.
Assume for a minute that suppose EPA's right about 165 and 167. Suppose those are unambiguous and that this is all driven by the statute. Tell me where the coercion comes from. What's the coercion? Texas in this case has done nothing, right?
Your Honor, it is not the case that Texas has done nothing. With respect, Texas is standing on its statutory rights that reflected constitutional rights.
Right.
When you approach a state in a coercive manner, when you tell the state to turn in a dime, and this has nothing
to do with it. What was coercive?
Let's unpack what a construction moratorium is. Construction moratorium not only threatened to injure Texas industry, I would submit that...
Wait. My questions are based on the assumption that EPA is right about 165 and 167.
If EPA is right, we basically have scrambled, read out of existence Section 110. SIPs become irrelevant. If I may briefly explain why. The reason states are interested in the SIPs, which is, to me, the most highest embodiment of cooperative federalism, is because they invest their prestige, they invest resources. They have certainty, but for duration of approved SIPs, they are the exclusive permitting authority. And EPA can introduce new requirements in a deliberate fashion. If states can be knocked off their perch on a 30-day timeline, the whole enterprise makes no sense. Then SIPs become incredibly coercive, and I would submit to you that the entire clean air edifice, about which you care very deeply, cannot be run without states.
Didn't they all work in this case? Didn't most states revise their SIPs? In fact, all but one of them got their SIPs revised.
We have problems in Wyoming that would be addressed, but with respect, Your Honor, the clear teaching of Bond in New York. The clear teaching of cases like Bond in New York, that just because some states have succumbed to federal blackmail, it does not cure the problem, because the federalism architecture exists not only for the benefit of the states, but for the benefits of the people. So it does not work. It is inconceivable to me that procedures that Congress very carefully cabined in 110 can degenerate to the point where EPA comes in and says, you have 30 days, and we're going to have a construction moratorium, which, among other things, means you are no longer permitting authority. You cannot issue valid permits. Or amend your SIPs in 21 days. Everybody knows you cannot do that. You come in and you do the FIP. That does not make sense as a proposition that is consistent with our federalism architecture. It also does not make sense given the plain meaning of 110I and 110 as a whole.
110 speaks in terms of revisions to the NAAQS, and EPA argues that, therefore, 110 by its terms doesn't apply here, and therefore resort to 110K5 is appropriate. Can you respond to that?
Yes, Judge Kennedy. First of all, 110A1 deals with NAAQS covered pollutant. 110A2 deals with non-NAAQS covered pollutant. EPA has used 110K5, but by its plain meaning, if you look at the last section of it, only deals, it's a narrow exception to otherwise interlocking set of requirements of 110. It only deals with those requirements that existed at the time the SIP was developed and submitted, which clearly was not the case with carbon. Moreover, 110I, which is really the most important subsection as far as we're concerned in reading this together, says very clearly that the only way a state or EPA can change any requirement that applies to a portion of us of dealing with stationary sources is perceived under 110A or 110C, not K. And that is what meant to function as a permit shield. I mean, let's keep in mind, this is probably the most important SIP program, Your Honor, because much of a country's in attainment right now. The PSD program is really what drives. I mean, there are other requirements in the SIP, what drives the SIP. So EPA does great textual violence to the language of Section 110I by operating in a, reading out of a, misreading Section K5, reading out of existence 110I, and engaging in this coercive conduct. And in our view, the proper way of reading Section 110 harmonizes. By the way, one point apropos of Judge Tatel's question, we're not saying 165A4 is not meaningful. There's at least a number of states left where EPA is the permitting authority for the PSD program. In those states, EPA can easily modify, and they so done, their permitting programs to reflect the introduction of carbon as a pollutant subject to regulation. Nobody, Your Honors, has protested that. The problem arises in all the other states where you do have cooperative federalism exercise in the form of a SIP, where you take the states as you find them, consistent with their sovereign dignity, and you have to proceed under carefully cabined authority under Section 110. And again, the teaching of City of Brightsburg and a number of other cases is you cannot just in an ad hoc fashion modify SIPs, and that's what EPA has done here.
I want to ask you another what if question about standing, but are you going to talk about standing or is that going to be in the next case?
Well, standing was not pressed, Your Honor, by DOJ below, but I would say that
That's okay. Well, my question is, again, what is the what if question? Let's assume 165 and 167, that we think they're clear and unambiguous, and that there is no, this case is not like Spencer, and that the statute was self-executing in January 2011. Now, if that's the case, where's the, don't you have a serious standing problem in view of our decision in Coalition with respect to the timing and tailoring rules? In other words, everything EPA did with respect to the SIP call and the error correction rules alleviated the construction moratorium. In other words, it reduced the injury.
A couple of points, yeah. Your Honor. First of all, sort of a basic case law out of this and other circuits. A final SIP call, irrespective of anything else, affects a legally cognizable injury, and we're dealing with a SIP call in this case. This is teaching of West Virginia versus EPA out of his circuit. This is the teaching.
Well, we have Coalition here, which I'm focusing specifically on the holding in that case. You understand what I'm asking?
Okay, CLR, great. Which we carefully studied, did not dispose of any SIP related issue.
I agree with that totally. It wasn't before the court, but the question, the holding of Coalition, namely that the states were not injured by the tailoring rule, seems to me a lot like this case.
Well, with respect, the issues relating to Section 110 were not before you. In fact, I recall in the oral argument there was a colloquy between Judge Rogers and I believe Mr. Brunell. The import on page 28 and 25 of our argument transcript, the import of which is very clear, the SIP issues are for this case.
I agree with that, but I'm asking you whether or not the holding of that case, that the states and industry petitioners were not injured by a provision by the timing and tailoring rules because they ameliorated the injury. Why doesn't that apply to everything EPA did here in terms of the time frames? That's my only question.
I understand. Let me increase as I can.
Go ahead.
The teaching of CR had to do with whether or not EPA could regulate carbon in a way it did, namely with non-statutory thresholds, and on the timeline it did. And you said that result did not injure states. That case had nothing to do with a timeline issue.
I was asking about that part of the case about the tailoring rule. Remember, the states challenged the tailoring rule, and we held in that case not only that the injury came directly from the statute, but that the tailoring rule couldn't be challenged, that the states lack standing.
I understand.
Because it ameliorated their
time. I understand. But again,
that's my question.
You are talking about, in that case, Your Honor, and of course, you were on that panel, about the substantive import of a tailing rule. Mm-hmm. That has nothing to do with what is the impact of that decision on the existence of a viable approved SIP. All we're talking about in this case, but it's very palpable, particularly given the separation of powers concerns, is how, on what timeline, in what mode EPA can proceed to translate that requirement into SIPs. But not just timeline alone, how you approach states, whether you tell states today, as EPA did in the SIP call, that your SIP is deficient within the next few days, or you tell them under 110A, there are new requirements you have to incorporate into your SIPs. We're not disparaging the quality of your SIPs today. That aspect is, has enormous constitutional significance. Nothing like that.
Let me ask you, what EPA said to Texas and the other 12 states was, under K-5, we're giving you 12 months.
But that was
You could do something different if you wanted to. And Texas's response was none of the arguments that we've heard today, but simply it had no intention of doing anything because it disagreed with the holding about greenhouse gases. Now, when the brief was written, it was before coalition was decided. But the question is, when Texas was arguing that it would be harmed by a moratorium on its ability to issue PSD permits, and EPA gave it options, not options that Texas wanted, and Texas responded that it had no intention of amending its SIP. Then EPA comes along and says, all right, to ameliorate the harm that Texas claims as a result of a moratorium, we're putting this FIP in place until such time as Texas modifies its SIP. So that's the question as to what is the harm. I understand your sovereign 10th Amendment argument, but I thought that's what Judge Tatel was trying to address.
Right. I appreciate you asking me this question because I would like to clear a couple of things up. First of all, we think that the 12 months was a cynical sham. That was the first choice. Yes, you have 12 months, because EPA knew, given the language of A2, even the language of K5, you have to be reasonable. But it's 12 months that have no legal significance, Judge Rogers, because of the 30-day moratorium. Now, very important as to, so the one choice and the 21 days was you are going to, because again, EPA knew they have no power to promulgate the FIP under 110C unless the state gave a premature deadline, fail it, and then they proceed with the FIP. So you have two coercive, non-viable choices. Very important to clarify what the Texas said in its letter. Texas never said that we're not going to regulate carbon in an orderly fashion. Texas in its letter, while it referenced the other rules, the gravamen of Texas's injury was, we are co-equal sovereigns. You approach us in a posture of profound disrespect.
But are you talking about the letter of joint appendix? Are you talking about the letter from the Attorney General?
Yes, Your Honor.
Texas has neither the authority nor the intention of interpreting its laws in order to compel the greenhouse gas.
That was, if I may, Judge Tatel, that was in response to EPA's desire to have, and this is an important subset of his case, the so-called automatic updating, which I submit to you is very constitutionally dubious. But Texas, under its state law, and that's the case for a variety of states, could the word subject to regulation under Texas Constitution, as construed by the Texas Supreme Court, was that it was limited to what the term meant at the time the SIP was approved. So that just disposed of EPA's argument that presto pronto, you can have an infinitely malleable SIP. And by the way,
we shouldn't read that.
But other jurisdictions were in a similar situation and indicated to EPA that they would make efforts to get their laws revised. That was not the nature of Texas's response.
But I'm responding to a specific question from Judge Tatel as to regard to that first sentence, which I remember very clearly. The broader import of Texas's letter, if you look at it in its entirety, was this. We are not going to proceed to regulate carbon in the way you outline under the SIP call. Texas never said, but in fact, Texas clearly said how you should proceed.
No, Texas actually said it disagreed that greenhouse gases were regulable, and it had no intention of moving forward. Now, I realize time has passed and its position may have modified somewhat, but the question is, can you show harm in the sense of what would the redressable injury be here?
A redressable injury is to vacate the SIP, and again, I hate to depart from environment. Is to vacate the SIP call. I hate to depart from environmental law,
and
but
then,
I
let me just follow through. Excuse me. Then you would have a moratorium in your state, which you said would be, which Texas said would be very harmful to.
We believe that we would not have a moratorium, Your Honor, if you give a proper force, the proper legal effect, but language of Section 110, particularly Section 110I. What EPA should do, but the relief we're seeking is to vacate the SIP call with this unlawful threat, have EPA come to the state of Texas under proper timeline, that of 110A2, give state a reasonable amount of time, as 110A2 requires, and then the state, and to emphasize, this is, if I may.
Suppose we feel bound by Coalition and Spencer and these other cases, and we think that 165 and 167 are clear. Then what's your answer to Judge Rogers' question? What's the remedy?
What would we do?
You would then, as she said, have the statutory moratorium in place, right?
There's nothing
we could do about that, right?
We do not believe, Your Honor, that the statutory moratorium can be imposed on a state like Texas.
No, but that's why I asked it as a what-if question. In other words, if we think we're bound by our precedent, and it's 165 and 67 that impose the moratorium, then, as Judge Rogers said, if we vacate the regulations, including the FIP, then you won't be able to have any construction in Texas.
Two answers again. I want to be respectful of the hypothetical, Judge Tatel, but again, that we do not construe your holding in CR to apply a moratorium in these circumstances. But if you're asking me what would happen, I would say this. Again, the issue of how a state is treated by EPA in the context of Section 110 and cooperative federalism is a totally distinct issue from what obligations are given industry or sediment does.
Even with a moratorium, you still want 3 years to do the SIP, right?
Well, 3 years if they proceed under A1 or in accordance with the rules in Part 51, but certainly at the very least, Judge Kavanaugh, a reasonable amount of time laid out. Let me emphasize the fact that the way EPA justified construction moratorium was not just with regard to sources you cannot construct. It says you as the state of Texas cannot issue viable permit. Texas, the permitting authority, was dethroned. That is a quintessential sovereign injury. My fear is that if you were to rule this way, you would render a portion of a Clean Air Act unconstitutional. And you have to strive mightily with respect to avoid reaching that result. And the only way to reconcile 165 and 110, your holding in CRR and what we're seeking here, is not to so rule.
All right. Why don't we hear from others, and we'll give you a minute on rebuttal, all right?
Thank you very much, Judge Rogers.
All right. Counsel for the State of Wyoming.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Nancy Veer, and I am an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Wyoming Attorney General's Office, representing the State of Wyoming in these consolidated cases. Before I start my argument, I'd like to address a couple of questions. Judge Tatel, you had asked that assuming EPA is correct about Section 165, what would allow the states to operate? And EPA had promulgated a regulation back in 2002 under 40 CFR 51.166 that allows states under the system of cooperative federalism to respond to changes in their state implementation plans and give those states 3 years.
Well, Wyoming came to EPA and said, essentially, we're not happy, but we're prepared to do the 21-day turnaround.
Wyoming.
Isn't that correct? That's in the record.
That is not correct.
Well, your governor wrote a letter, and then the Wyoming Department wrote a letter.
In terms of writing the letters, that portion is correct, but Wyoming ceded to EPA's pressures, the time pressures of being in 3 weeks, EPA's position that sources in Wyoming would be under a construction ban, and the only way out of this was for Wyoming to cede to EPA's demands and accept this early deadline. Wyoming did not agree with EPA's position.
So the letter was misinforming the agency?
No, the letter did not misinform the agency. What the letter did was inform the agency that there was a statute on Wyoming's books that prohibited the state from regulating greenhouse gases. EPA, in its proposed rule, said that Wyoming's state implementation plan was presumptively adequate. There's nothing in the record until EPA flip-flopped its position to say that Wyoming's plan was being called as substantially inadequate. And Wyoming has had a statute on the books that prohibited the regulation of greenhouse gases. We needed to have EPA uphold the rights of the states, the sovereign rights to implement the Clean Air Act under this cooperative federalism. In fact, Wyoming, its legislature in 2012, met and authorized the state of Wyoming, Department of Environmental Quality, and the Environmental Quality Council to adopt greenhouse gas regulations. And again, in 2013, the state of Wyoming's legislature authorized the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality to submit those regulations to EPA. And even though EPA gave the state of Wyoming 3 weeks to adopt a state implementation plan, Wyoming's submitted a state implementation plan on greenhouse gases to EPA in March of this year, and it's still sitting down in EPA. All Wyoming asked was for EPA to honor its obligation under Section 101 of the Clean Air Act for the system of cooperative federalism and allow the state the first right to regulate these sources.
Now you cited the regulation, which gives you 3 years, and EPA responds that the regulation doesn't apply here because the state wasn't required to revise its implementation plan by reason of an amendment to this section, namely to 51.166. Can you respond to that?
Yes. In EPA's tailoring rule, it revised 51.166 by defining greenhouse gases and incorporating that definition, and also modifying the term subject to regulation within the definition of an NSR-regulated pollutant. It is by those very actions that triggered the timing rule, this 51.166, which would allow the state to have first dibs at regulating these sources.
So let me ask you a question similar to the one I asked Mr. Rifkin. Assume that we feel bound by our precedent and that the requirement to have a greenhouse gas compliant permits flows directly from the statute, okay?
Okay.
Given that Wyoming has already submitted its SIP, right?
That's correct.
So with respect to Wyoming, why isn't this case then moot?
It's not moot because as of right now, sources in the state of Wyoming are operating under a dual permitting system. When EPA took over the greenhouse gas portion, sources in the state of Wyoming have to go to EPA Region 8 to get a greenhouse gas permit, and they go to the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality for criteria pollutant permits.
Well, if the EPA approves the SIP, does it become moot at that point?
No, Wyoming's already suffered injury. And it's not in the record, and I apologize.
What's the redress? What could we do? Do you want us to vacate the permits that have been granted in the past couple of years?
No.
I didn't think so.
But you
don't want us to do that. Yeah. So what would we do?
This court would vacate the state implementation plan call, the finding of failure, and the federal implementation plan. And I believe in the court doing so could recognize that EPA had issued permits to those sources, but if you'd like, I could follow up with some briefing to the court on.
No, that's okay. I'm just curious about, and how would that correct your, how would that, so it would sort of be, we would be, it would be kind of like, it would be correcting a sort of a symbolic injury, right?
We
would
no, there, Your Honor, I, no disrespect, but this has not been a symbolic injury to the state of Wyoming. This is under our sovereign rights, EPA, in terms of implementing under the Clean Air Act's cooperative federalism.
Right, but all my questions are, no, that's okay, but all my questions are based on the assumption that it was the statute that imposed the January 2011 requirement, not EPA.
But in,
and if that's the case, what I'm asking you is what, even if there is some injury to Wyoming, and I hear what you're saying about it, even if there is an injury to Wyoming's sovereign interest, what could we do about that? What would be the remedy we would impose that could correct that injury?
To vacate the SIP call and the Fed finding of failure in the federal implementation plan.
But how would that change anything in Wyoming?
Wyoming has adopted regulations, has proceeded to develop these greenhouse gas regulations and submitted a...
And if EPA approves that SIP, then...
Wyoming will be restored to its permitting authority. However, as I mentioned, there is one source in the state of Wyoming that has received a greenhouse gas permit from EPA, and the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality was not allowed to issue a permit.
Wait, explain that. What happened?
There is a, and again, this isn't a record, so
that's okay. Just I'm curious. I wanted to ask you about this anyway.
Okay.
So what happened?
There is a source in Wyoming, Black Hills Power and Lights Prairie Generating Station, and they had to go down to EPA Region 8 to get the greenhouse gas permit. This is after the federal plan was imposed, and they had to go to the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality for the criteria pollutant permit.
And did Wyoming grant that part of it?
Wyoming granted that part of the permit.
Okay.
When Wyoming grants a permit, it's final. When EPA grants a permit, it's not final unless it's not appealed within a certain period of time, and then it becomes final. So this source was not allowed to construct after Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality granted the permit. They had to wait until the EPA permit was granted and not appealed.
Kylie, didn't EPA offer to delegate its FIP authority to the states?
EPA offered to delegate its FIP authority, but that would be operating under federal law. It is of great importance to Wyoming to operate under Wyoming law. And we've gone through in the 30 years that Wyoming has had an EPA-approved SIP. This is the first time that EPA has told the state it had 3 weeks to amend its state implementation plan when EPA's own rules require that state implementation plan amendments go through a public notice comment process of over 30 days. And there is absolutely no way that the state could have met these requirements in 3 weeks. And the state was very concerned when the decision came out in 2010 that this was a time of economic difficulties across the nation. And here EPA had told Wyoming that unless it complied, it would be under this construction ban. Mm-hmm. And EPA can regulate, the state's beef is not that EPA can't regulate sources directly. EPA does that all the time through new source performance standards, national emission standards for hazardous air pollutants. But the PSD, the Prevention of Significant Deterioration Program, is one that is implemented by states through their state implementation plans. And that's why it has to get modified in the proper manner, and EPA did not do that here. And I see I'm out of time. I don't want to go over my time if there's no more questions.
Thank you. All right, counsel for the Utility Air Regulatory Group.
May it please the court. I'm Henry Nickel. I represent the Utility Air Regulatory Group. A simple principle of administrative law is at the heart of petitioner's challenge. That principle is that legislative rules, like the rules that are contained in EPA-approved state implementation plans, including PSD state implementation plans, govern future conduct until lawfully revised. Those rules are not overridden by any self-executing statutory provision that's found in Part C, including Section 165. Unlike the Clean Water Act, which prohibits any discharge of a pollutant without a permit, Part C of the Clean Air Act, the PSD title, calls upon EPA in Section 161 to adopt regulations that will define the requirements for state implementation plans. And those regulations are, of course, based on each of the individual sections which define the statutory requirements for the PSD program. Once those rules are established, and those rules are the so-called Part 51-166 rules, then the states are to revise their SIPs to conform to the rules. Now, when the rules are changed, EPA adopted a specific legislative rule to govern the submission of implementation plans to implement the new requirements for the PSD program. That is the provision which has been mentioned earlier, Section 166A6. Section 166A6 does two things, and they're very important to our challenge in this case. One, it gives states 3 years to develop revised state implementation plans. 3 years is very important. This is a brand new regulatory program of real complexity. The agency has defined new statutory thresholds and treats this pollutant differently than any other pollutant. There's a matrix for calculating tons that doesn't apply anywhere else. The 166A6 calls upon the states to, in revising their SIPs, identify the sources to which
the program would EPA be. Could revise this regulation or amend this regulation and put in a period of 9 months instead of 3 years?
EPA could repeal this regulation as far as, or could establish a different regulation with a different time frame. I believe that's correct, Your Honor. As far as whether it could go down to 9 months, I think there's some serious questions about that. But EPA
Why?
Has brought
well, just... Where do the questions arise from? Because I'm trying to tease out the difference between your reliance on the regulation and then the statutory arguments.
Okay. Well, first thing, I would say that the question about whether it could move to 9 months or 3 months or 6 months may be a question of whether or not the states would have a reasonable time to revise their SIPs. In 1977, the period of time for adopting state implementation plans to implement ambient standards and to adopt legislative rules and incorporate them into state implementation plans was a 9-month period. In the 1990 amendments, EPA changed that to 3 years for state implementation plans. I would agree that the deadline for A2 plans, which are the PSD program, are not specified in the statute. And so the agency would have discretion to establish a different time frame than the 3 years that the agency did. But the agency did set that time frame, and it is a binding legislative rule. And the agency has circumvented that rule by its conduct in this case. Section 165, according to EPA, and this is what EPA told the states, prohibits the states after January 2nd from issuing issuing PSD permits under EPA-approved programs that do not contain GHG limitations. In other words, EPA interprets the statute as overriding a legislative rule, a federally enforceable legislative rule, without any administrative action.
Suppose it's right about that.
I thought you might ask me that question.
Gee, I wonder why. So what's the answer?
The answer is, if your question means that And I don't think the CRO case stands for this. But if your question means that assume Section 165 did in fact change the state plans so that they could no longer issue valid permits after August 7th.
Right.
And that is a valid interpretation of 165.
Yeah.
Then I would agree. We don't have a case.
Okay.
And we don't have standing. But.
So it all turns on this interpretation of the statute. And.
Well, there's two issues. And, but be careful for you.
Well, I will be careful.
And there's even if 160, there's still a 110K5 versus a 110A1 issue, and how the regulation plays into that, right?
Yes. And let me just say that accepting your hypothetical creates real problems when we look at the legislative rules. And again, I began my argument saying this is a question of what do legislative rules mean under the Clean Air Act and the APA. Your hypothetical means that the three-year rule still seems to apply, but of course states that take advantage of that three-year rule would be facing a construction moratorium for that three-year period.
Well, but
they might still want their SIPs rather than the FIP, though, right? I mean, that's the.
They might.
I thought that was the point the states were getting.
They might, but then let's look at another part of 166A6. It tells the states they have 3 years, and the SIPs that they adopt, they may apply them prospectively from the time of EPA approval. Now, this gets to a very important point in terms of standing and questions that were raised earlier about what's happening out in the states and whether or not this court's granting of relief would ameliorate harm. And in preparing for argument, I went back and checked on some of the states that were exceeded to EPA's threat, as I would call it, of a construction moratorium, and are facing a situation where they issue PSD permits for conventional pollutants, and EPA issues PSD permits for GHG pollutants. In Florida, there are five permits that have been issued by the state, final permits, but they can't construct because they're for the conventional pollutants. Those five permits have applications pending before EPA. EPA has only found that one of them is complete. This is somewhat reflective of the complexity of this program and why 3 years was provided for implementing a rule that occupies, 11 column inches in the Federal Register. If this court were to grant the relief that we are requesting, it would mean that in the case of Florida, EPA's FIP would be vacated, EPA's authority to grant the permits for GHGs would be extinguished, that the states could continue to issue permits under their pre-existing SIPs, their approved SIPs, and the five permits that are pending before EPA could automatically issue.
Well, that only works if you're right about your interpretation of the statute.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. If I'm right about my interpretation,
then you're totally
statute,
right.
I got that.
You're
really
completely right. But if you're not, then the consequences of vacating the FIP will be no construction permits in Florida, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And the consequence of that holding also will be inconsistent with 166A6. And it's absolutely correct that if the world we face is a world that whenever EPA changes its Part 51-166 rules, Section 165 kicks in to stop permitting until those rules are implemented, we're dealing with a fundamentally different program than those legislative rules and 110 contemplate.
Well, let me ask you a question. We heard a lot about cooperative federalism. And the question I had is if you look at the Clean Air Act as a whole, one could posit that there is a very important, predominant, major, however you wish to characterize it, state role in the NAC concept, developing how we're going to carry this out within the states. But once you're in an attainment area, and we've got the SIPs for all the NACs, now we're dealing with a statutory provision Congress passed that said, these are my words, not Congress, obviously, but the point is, good, we have clean air in all these places, and we want to be certain that as to new pollutants that are regulated by EPA, that we keep that clean air. So this requirement for new construction and modification that says you have to get a permit that covers these new pollutants, and that applies to the sources directly, that kicks in immediately because Congress wanted to keep the air clean. And the states may face this time bind, and it's their choice, as it were. Either they can act quickly, as a number of states told EPA they could, or they couldn't act quickly, as counsel for Wyoming suggested. And they faced a bind as to whether there could be any construction or not. So this two-permit system was put in place so Wyoming utilities and other facilities could get their permits, but Wyoming also could amend its statute and take whatever steps it needed to get the new SIP reg to EPA, as Wyoming has done. Now, why isn't that a consistent scheme that, at least in this instance, EPA was trying to cooperate with the states, recognizing the states face this time bind, and gave the states some options? Some states were perfectly happy with that. Some states were not. So I just want to be clear about what cooperative federalism means in getting to clean air, as distinct from Congress saying this permitting requirement kicks in immediately on the sources, and it may put the states in a bind as far as their SIPs are concerned. But it doesn't mean that necessarily everything has to stop because EPA was authorized by Congress to issue this FIP in this way. That's the argument and sort of what's wrong with it. And I know in one of your reply briefs, you come up with this concept that's quite different. So that's why I took some time to ask you this alternative way of looking at it.
No, I'll try to answer.
Yeah.
First, I think your question proceeds from the assumption that Judge Tatel asked me to make, and that is that Section 165 is self-executing, and therefore it commands, notwithstanding the provisions that are contained in a plan, everyone after that date that the rule becomes effective has to have GHG limits. And if the statute requires that, I would agree that that would be the way it probably should work in order to keep the trains running. What I disagree with is that's not the way the Clean Air Act works. And you mentioned one case, and there was a second case mentioned, Spencer County and Alabama Power. And I hate to admit it, but I was counsel in both of those cases. And I think I remember what was involved in them. I without going back and reading them again. What's important about the 77 amendments was they codified an existing regulatory program. EPA had been ordered by a court to establish a clean air program for...
You're talking about the congressional amendments.
77, yes, ma'am. They codified the 1974 PSD rules that EPA had adopted in response to a court order. They changed those rules in certain respects. And what was in effect at the time was what was called at that time federally promulgated state implementation plans in all of the states establishing the permit program. And 165 and 168, the battle there was about what PSD requirements became immediately incorporated into those 1974 regulations. Right. And the answer is telling. The answer was that nothing could happen until EPA exercised rulemaking discretion to revise the legislative rules that defined the state implementation plan, federally promulgated permit program. And they revised those rules. And they didn't revise them to say August 7, 77. They didn't revise them to say 18 months after that. They revised them to say March of 78. Similarly, in Alabama Power, there were two sets of rules that were before the court, identical rules. One were the rules that became 51-166, and the other were Part 52 rules. Again, those are the rules that amended those EPA programs.
But the question in both, I don't mean to interrupt you, but let's get to the heart of the cases, and then, good, maybe you can help me with it since you argued them. I mean, we're bound by the holding of the case. And this background you're giving us is interesting, but Spencer says Section 165 by its terms, explicitly and without qualification, prohibits construction of any major polluting emitting source unless the substantive requirements have been met with regard to that facility. I mean, it says what EPA is interpreting 165 as meaning here in January 2011.
The court said that, and
we said it again in Alabama.
It can only be implemented through changes to the federal implementation plan or the state implementation plan. And what was before the court were those legislative rules. Now, before the court in CRR were legislative rules that, you know, we argued the agency had discretion to do something different than they did. The court found that the statute automatically regulated. That resolution doesn't resolve this case, which deals with what is the time frame for implementing those new rules that were not reviewed because of standing issues.
All right.
Speaking of the time frame, just one more question. The 3-year period is up in June. This June.
Yes.
What are the consequences of that for?
As I indicated, mm-hmm. if this court were, we filed this case shortly after the rule became effective. But if the court were to accept the argument that we have put forward, then the FIPS would be vacated with the consequence that the states could continue to issue permits under their approved program. That would mean certain permits could issue. Other permits could issue until the state implementation plans were revised or EPA promulgated a FIP. The expiration of the June 3rd deadline might provide a basis for EPA finding a failure to submit, which is the first step toward establishing a FIP.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. My name is Madeline Fleischer. I'm representing respondent, the Environmental Protection Agency. I'll be addressing the statutory issues in today's case, while my colleague Matt Oakes will be discussing the regulatory side as well as petitioner's 10th Amendment and notice arguments. With respect to the statutory issues, I think we all recognize that the starting point has to be this court's holding in the recent case Coalition for Responsible Regulation, which recognized that the plain language of Section 165 directly and automatically applies the statute's PSD requirements to major emitting facilities. It unambiguously does so without regard to the contents of any applicable implementation plan. Now, it's true that many states do issue PSD permits under a state implementation plan. And since the PSD requirements are independent of that, in this factual situation, there ended up being a temporary gap in the state's permitting authority pending basically the catch-up of their SIPs through a revision to address greenhouse gases. However, that does not mean that the SIPs were extinguished in any respect. They were simply insufficient to meet the statutory PSD requirements under Section 165.
So when there's a change in the NACs, new or revised NACs, is there a construction moratorium that goes takes effect until the state has revised its implementation plan, under your theory?
EPA has recognized, I believe the example we cited in our brief was PM 2.5, that the PSD requirements would apply immediately in the case of that NACS revision. Yes, that doesn't change the plain language of the statute continues to apply there.
Mm-hmm. By the way, is that that's a Chevron 1 argument you're making, right?
It's correct.
Clear point. Suppose we're convinced by the petitioners here that given the other statutory provisions, it's not quite so clear and there's an ambiguity here. What do we do then if we're at Chevron 2? We don't have an EPA interpretation of the statute at that level, do we?
I think that you do, in effect, have an EPA interpretation of the statute. I think this gets to the core question of, is this a case
where
like...
Where do we have that?
I would point to, I guess, the original PSD regulations, which promulgated in 1978, 1980, and 2002.
No, but EPA's position all along has been that the statute's unambiguous, so it's never felt the need to exercise any delegated authority to interpret an ambiguous statute. That's my point.
I guess this may be splitting hairs, but...
Well, that's what we do on the D.C. Circuit all the time.
Okay, then I will go ahead. I would say that EPA's decision that the statute is unambiguous implicitly requires a judgment that there's no other, statutory provisions or the sorts of things you would consider...
No, you're saying it's unambiguous, but my question is, suppose we don't think so. Suppose we think it's ambiguous, then what do? We don't have an agency interpretation. We don't have any effort here by EPA to reconcile these statutes to which we could defer.
If there is any ambiguity, it must be rooted in some sort of authority, some other provision of the statute.
Well, the petitioners have given us quite a few other provisions of the statute that they say conflicts with this in terms of time periods for SIPs and the cooperative federalism program and all that, and their view is that this is ambiguous because of that. And I know you don't agree with that, but I'm asking whether if we think it's ambiguous, what do we do next?
I think you can say
you can't answer that question by saying the statute's clear.
My answer would be that if you think there's that some provision they've cited or something creates ambiguity in the statute, EPA, in the course of promulgating both its basic PSD regulations and also the SIP call, had all that information before it at the time and reached the conclusion that there was no ambiguity. In effect, the agency's analysis implicitly contained a Chevron 2 type determination.
I think our precedents say the opposite on that, right. We have the remand in that kind of situation, right, where the agency didn't recognize its own discretion.
And that's certainly within this court's discretion to have
what
that.
What about the idea that the SIP is the foundation of the whole PSD program, which I take to be petitioner's argument that all the different statutory provisions that set up the whole program as being a SIP-centered program unless the state fails to do it, in which case the FIPs come in, but that this short-circuits that and essentially coerces the state's into giving up their rights, statutory rights, under the statute. How do you respond to that?
The problem with that view is it has no basis in the actual language of the statute. The plain language of the PSD provisions, 165, 167.
When you start at 161, it's all about state implementation plans, right?
Yes, and 161 is not. It's not like Spencer County, where this is directly speaks to permitting requirements. It speaks to how you create a SIP sufficient to carry out those permitting requirements. In our view, provides the authority for EPA to promulgate regulations defining what an acceptable SIP would be. But 165 is a separate provision with no reference to regulations. Section 165 says you have to comply with the statute. And Section 167, I think, is even clearer in that it says you can, EPA can enforce against a source that seeks to construct without a permit that fails to comply with the statutory requirements, but also if there's an applicable implementation plan that doesn't comply with the statutory requirements, EPA has enforcement authority there. The entire permitting requirement itself is framed in statutory terms. And you have a directly contrasting example in the non-attainment provisions of how Congress could say that it was keying a permitting requirement to what's in an applicable limitation plan. Sections 172 and 173, as well as the enforcement, the applicable enforcement provision for non-attainment 113, all say that the relevant authority is the applicable implementation plan. And so I think that as Judge Rogers was speculating, you can certainly have a world where even though you might prefer to implement the Clean Air Act's requirements through SIPs, that doesn't mean that those requirements cease to exist. And there might be situations where implementation through a SIP is not something that Congress felt was necessary. And the language of the PSD provisions reflects that.
What about the regulation? I guess your colleague's going to get to that, but it blends into that. Does your theory mean the regulation from 2002 is unlawful?
I will leave that to my colleague and simply
preview the answer. Is that a yes or no?
I'm happy to preview with the caveat that he should feel free to come up and say I'm wrong. Okay. But I think that the two-pronged preview would be that we don't think it's inconsistent because the section, our interpretation of Section 165 relates to this world of a particular situation of newly regulated pollutants.
The regulation was about new PSD requirements.
Which are separate things. In our view, the language of Section 165, as this court has held, by operation of statute, applies PSD requirements with respect to newly regulated pollutants. That doesn't mean there can't be other changes in implementation of PSD that might be accomplished through an amendment to EPA's regulations, which would be where 51.166 would kick in. I will also just add the second prong, which is that if EPA's regulation is inconsistent with the plain language of the statute wins.
I'm curious, what's given EPA's position here that 165 and 167 are unambiguous and require regulation in January 2011. How's that argument consistent with the agency's position with the tailoring rule?
So in what respect?
The tailoring. Well, the tailoring rule, I mean, if 165 and 167 are clear, then what's the authority for the tailoring rule?
I think that was dealt with in CRR.
Only too well.
I guess I will refer back to the various doctrines that EPA cited in that case of administrative necessity.
Right. But if EPA had the authority when it issued the tailoring rule to relieve states and the regulated community of the immediate application of the statute, why couldn't they do it here?
Because none of the doctrines justifying that admitted deviation from the plain language of the statute are present here. Uh-huh. There's no absurd results. There's no administrative necessity.
Well, what about reconciling the statute with notions of cooperative federalism?
The notions of cooperative federalism are what Congress laid them out to be in the plain language of the statute. I wouldn't say that EPA feels free to go speculate about what Congress might have meant and modify plain language under 165 accordingly.
I suppose another answer to your question is, in Coalition, we never did deal with whether or not the Taylor rule was legal, correct?
That's still an open question. That would be correct, but I would say that even if you had addressed it and upheld it, that would be irrelevant here because those principles don't apply in this case.
So why isn't the better, this might again be a colleague question, but why isn't the better way to think about this, keying off Judge Tatel's question, that there's a gap potentially between, say, A1 and K5, or there's ambiguity for how 165 fits into the SIP as a whole, and that the regulation from 2002 was designed to fill that gap or address that ambiguity and said the Act does not specify a date for submission of SIPs when we revise the PSD and NSR rules. Well, the PSD rules were revised here. We believe it is appropriate to establish a date analogous to the date for submission of new SIPs. That's the classic kind of agency language when they see provisions that conflict or there's a gap, either way you want to phrase it here, and that regulation's still on the books. EPA could amend it, but I don't see how we can just ignore it here. You kind of said, well, if it's inconsistent with the statute, just say it's inconsistent with the statute, but it's a binding regulation that's on the books that seems designed to fill a gap that or an ambiguity that EPA saw.
I will leave this principally to my colleague and simply say that the gap it's meant to fill is where there's an alteration to EPA's PSD regulation.
And weren't they altered
that
here?
They
were altered here.
I think this runs directly into this course holding in CRR.
No, but were they were altered?
I don't have the language in front of me, and I'll.
They were altered.
They were altered, but as this court held in CRR, that was not the source of the requirement.
They were changed here. They were changed here to set the specific numerical requirements that come into play now when you have to get PSD permit for CO2. Right?
I will definitely leave that to Mr. Oakes.
Okay. All right. Anything further that you'd like to say? Because we keep getting into your colleague's area.
Yes. Just to conclude, if the court has no further questions, the plain language of sections 165 and 167 governs here.
And is it your position, is it the agent's position that because of that, there's no standing to raise any of the other issues? You made that argument in the Texas case, but not here.
With respect to standing, obviously this court had not decided CRR at the time we were briefing this case, but should the court feel it's appropriate to reevaluate standing in light of that decision, we certainly recognize that the burden is on petitioners to make their standing case.
And have they made it is the question.
Yeah.
I will leave that to them.
You leave it to them?
You have no position?
No position on that?
I would say that this does have a lot of similarities to CRR in that this action is not the source of the PSD permitting requirement about which petitioners complain.
All right. Your colleague can add to that, I think. Right. Well, since he's doing the 10th Amendment. All right, counsel for respondent.
May it please court, Matthew Oakes on behalf of respondent, the Environmental Protection Agency. First, I'd like to address the question that Judge Kavanaugh just raised with respect to 51.166A6. You asked, wasn't there an amendment to 51.166 caused by the Taylor rule? And there was. There's no doubt the language of 166 was changed, but if you look at the language of A6 and what triggers that three-year timing provision, what triggers it isn't the amendment itself, but instead 166A6 applies where any state is required to revise its implementation plan by reason of an amendment to this section.
Right.
In other words,
an amendment to this section. Keep going.
In other words, it's the requirement is not only attached to the amendment itself, but it's attached to the impact of that amendment. If that amendment changes requirements for the state, then that change in requirements is what triggers the timing provision. Right. Here, the tailoring rule itself did not cause the states to have any additional requirements. And that's something that's consistent with this court's holding in the CRR case, where this court stated, the Clean Air Act mandates PSD and Title V coverage for major emitters of greenhouse gases. Thus, industry petitioners were regulated and state petitioners required to issue permits, not because of anything EPA did in the timing and tailoring rules, but by automatic operation of the statute. So this court has held.
The automatic operation of the statute, as I understand this, caused EPA to change the PSD rules, which in turn causes the states to have to revise their implementation plan.
The automatic operation of the statute created a new requirement that applied directly to the PSD program. It doesn't apply through 51.166.
I just stopped you there and caused, therefore, sensibly, in the CFR, there's new provisions in here that weren't there before that set targets, or not targets, limits that you can't exceed with CO2 emissions, and you know all the numbers, that weren't there before.
But even absent.
And they were there before because of the change in, or the determination that the statute covered, really, because of Mass versus EPA, right?
So if you step back and you say there was no tailoring rule at all, and those amendments never happened, and the question is, what impact would the regulation of greenhouse gases through the vehicle rule have on the states? The impact that that would have is that states would be required to regulate PSD directly, without benefit of the regulation at all. And all that the regulation did was it increased the regulatory thresholds as compared to the statutory thresholds, and that was an issue in the CRR case. But absent the regulation, if that regulation did not exist, the states would still be required to regulate greenhouse gases just at lower levels, and they would be required to do so not only through the direct application of the statutory provision, but also through the pre-existing regulations.
Right.
Before the amendment to subsection B48.
So it all hangs on by reason of for you. That the changes to the regs, which occurred, were not by reason, or that the changes, I'm sorry, to the implementation plan that are required, the revisions, are not by reason of amendment to the regulations.
That's exactly correct.
Right. Of course, in the preamble, it just talked about the act is when we revise the PSD and NSR rules. Anytime we revise the PSD and NSR rules, we think it appropriate to look by analogy to 110A1 and give 3 years. I don't know what you do with that language.
In which preamble?
Preamble. I mean, in the Federal Register provision of December 31, 2002, where it talks about explaining this change, the 2002 reg. It says the act does not specify a date for submission of SIPs when we revise the PSD and NSR rules. That's all it says. We believe it is appropriate to establish a date analogous to the date for submission of new SIPs when a NAAQS is promulgated or revised. Under Section 110A1 of the Act, as amended in 1990, that date is 3 years from promulgation or revision of the NAAQS. Accordingly, we have established 3 years from today's revisions as the required date for submission of conforming SIP revisions.
Right, and that three-year incorporation is something that the EPA has done in other settings as well. And the purpose of that is allowing states time to react to EPA amendments that cause states to have to revise their implementation plans. But this is a setting.
There would be a construction moratorium in place during that time, right?
In this setting, application of PSD.
What about in that setting?
Right. In that setting, the three-year plan in this particular setting, it doesn't apply because there was no triggering amendment. But that is written in response to an amendment by EPA that changes requirements that are not automatically applied to the states. And it incorporated that three-year provision because that three-year time frame was something that was alluded to elsewhere in the Act. And we've even done that in the next setting for PM10 and PM2.5, for example, where we've allowed states additional time.
What's the authority for allowing them additional time, given your interpretation of 165?
We didn't allow them additional time to regulate PSD in either of those cases. We created a surrogate in both of those cases. In the case of the initial regulation of PM10, the surrogate was total suspended particulates. And in the case of the initial regulation of PM2.5, the surrogate was the regulation of PM10. So in both of those cases, there was prior regulation of particulates. And that prior regulation of particulates, in both cases, in the agency's finding, and this is in the rulemaking, in both of those cases, the prior regulation effectively acted as a surrogate because the smaller category of newly regulated pollutants was subsumed by the larger category. So while the agency did allow states time to amend their SIPs, in that interim period, there was a surrogate approach to regulation of particulates.
And the regulation's still good law?
Which regulation, Your Honor?
51.166A.
51.166A6, the timing provision, is still good law. Okay. If you don't have additional questions about 51.166, I'd like to briefly address the 10th Amendment arguments.
And just to be sure I understand your argument about that, it was not by reason of an amendment to this section. That's your position?
That's correct, Your Honor. The requirement was not created by reason of amendment to this section.
It was created by 165.
That's right.
And where has the agency interpreted that regulation that way anywhere else?
The agency has consistently, in various settings, stated that PSD applies automatically, and it has not applied the three-year timing provision to preclude the automatic application.
Right, but has it ever done it in the context of this regulation? Is there any other place where it's explained that this regulation does not apply where the change derives from a statutory requirement?
I don't believe EPA has made that interpretation in this regulation.
Okay.
And just briefly with respect to the 10th Amendment arguments, our position is that the agency did not compel any state action in this case. EPA gave states the option and the ability to amend their SIPs and regulate themselves.
Is there any way in which take for example a state that has is operating under a FIP? Is there any way in which a permit can be granted in that state without the state's permission, without the state's consent?
Under this FIP?
Anywhere. Yes, under this FIP.
No, absolutely not. The states are still running the same permit program that they were running prior to issuance of this FIP. This FIP just fills a gap. There's a new statutory requirement. States, in some instances were not able to meet the requirements, and the federal government was able to step in using authority that had been granted to the federal government by Congress to create permitting authority in a FIP. So both are necessary to issue a valid permit here, but it doesn't change the state's SIP authorities in any way.
I want to go back to your answer to one of Judge Kavanaugh's questions so I'm clear. You were discussing PM, and you said, well, the agency didn't give additional time because there was a prior regulation of PM. It acted as a surrogate. Were you referring to a FIP?
No, I was referring to states that were regulating PM through SIPs. And in
who is acting as a surrogate? That's what I'm not clear on.
So the SIP plan that had been initially approved by the state for the other forms of the particulate matter was acting as a surrogate for the newly regulated forms of PM, either PM10 in 1987 or PM2.5 in the 2008 regulation they point to.
So the state had a SIP that included regulation of PM.
That's correct.
Then EPA came along with its regulation.
That's right.
And so amendments had to be made to the state's SIP.
Correct.
And what happened in the interim?
Two things. Initially, EPA said the PSD provisions are automatically applicable. The states have additional time to amend their SIPs to respond to the newly regulated pollutants.
So let's just assume that that's a six-month period.
Okay.
All right. Could a source, major emitting source of PM, get a permit under the state's pre-existing SIP?
In that instance, EPA held that the states could use their pre-existing SIPs to issue permits because the prior permits were acting as a surrogate for the newly regulated pollutant.
But surrogate for what is what I'm trying to understand. In other words, it's regulating PM at level 4. Then EPA comes out with a regulation that says PM has to be regulated at a level 10. So the state SIP doesn't do that. And a major emitting source of PM wants to get a permit. And it's faced with 165.
It was a different factual scenario, and I think that's what's causing some of the confusion here.
But the permits were issued during the time period, even if they complied with the old requirements in the SIPs, and so there was no construction moratorium, unlike this case.
Right, and the permits were able to issue because there was a surrogate in place, and the reason that that surrogacy system made sense is because in both instances, in 1987, EPA was transitioning from regulation of total suspended particulates, which is the entire spectrum of particulates that includes fairly large particulates. And then EPA stepped those regulations down to regulation of PM10, which is a relatively smaller level of particulates, and it was focusing its regulations and focusing its monitoring and its emissions calculations.
I'm not trying to get in the weeds here. That's why I gave you my hypothetical.
Okay.
I just want to be clear as to what EPA's position was as to the pre-existing SIP that was not regulating PM to the more stringent extent that the new EPA PM regulation required. And I think you answered to Judge Kavanaugh that the state was still able to issue a PM permit, a PSD permit, under the pre-existing SIP.
That's correct. And to answer in terms of your hypothetical, rather than stepping its regulations from a level 4 to a much more stringent level 10, what EPA did was it focused its regulations rather than on the initial level 4. It focused the measurement criteria it was using on, we'll say, a level 3. It was something that was encompassed by the initial regulations. It was more focused on a different type of particulate.
It was a stricter.
It was a stricter way of measurement and a stricter manner of calculation, but it was included by the prior regulated pollutant.
Just so I'm clear, if I am a major emitting source of PM and the state SIP required me to regulate and have the technology available to regulate PM at the level in the original state SIP, and then EPA comes out with a PM regulation that requires stricter controls, I would still be able to get my permit under the less strict controls under the state SIP.
I would say different, not less strict. And I have a quotation from the PM10 rule that may clarify this.
To me, as a major emitting source, different means I have to spend more money, if I can get to the point, to comply. But I'm just trying to be clear how EPA is distinguishing here. I thought that was the thrust.
What's your quotation? Will that help us?
I think so. What the agency said in its 2008 rule regarding PM 2.5, and this is on page 175 of the joint appendix, is that PM10 will act as an adequate surrogate for PM 2.5 in most respects, because all new major sources and major modifications that would trigger PSD requirements for PM 2.5 would also trigger PM10 requirements, because PM 2.5 is a subset of PM10.
Do you want to say, I'm sorry, were you done with it? Yeah. Do you have anything you want to say about standing, assuming you're right, giving the agency's interpretation of 165 and 167, what are the consequences of that for standing in this case?
Standing in this case, I believe there are standing issues in this case, and I think the standing issues.
Right, that's why I asked the question. What's the answer to them? Do they have standing?
I don't believe that. So when I think about standing, and I look at the two cases that are being heard by this court today, I find trouble seeing how they would have standing in the error correction case that follows this. This case seems
to me.
How
about this case? Let's talk about this case.
Right. I'm trying to get there. Okay. This case seems to focus on timing, and
they want to have 3 years to do the SIP without a construction moratorium. They're not being allowed to do that. That sounds like injury to me. They may be wrong on the merits, but if they're right on the merits, isn't that an injury and redressable?
I personally believe they have standing in this case.
Wait, standing to raise what?
What?
Yes. They clearly have standing to raise the question of
165 and 167. Everybody agrees with that, right?
Right.
Okay. Our question is, if the agency is taking the position that 165 and 67 are unambiguous.
That's correct.
Okay. I'm asking you what the consequences of that argument is for the petitioners in this case standing to raise their timing issues.
Right.
That's my question.
Right. The consequences of us prevailing on that argument would mean that petitioners don't have standing in this case because they wouldn't stand to benefit from the challenge to these rules.
Okay.
These rules would only inure to their benefit.
All right.
Wait a second. Getting 3 years to do a SIP as opposed to 3 weeks or a year and having a FIP imposed that might be different from the SIP that they would have come up with themselves if given the time, isn't that a problem? The SIP, their SIP could be different from the FIP and still meet the requirements, correct?
But there's no limit. So
is that correct? Their SIP could be different.
Their SIP could absolutely be different.
Okay. Well, then they might devise a different.
But standing doesn't necessarily flow from that because the question is what happens in the interim period. If they're entitled to 3 years to revise their SIP, and in the interim period they're not allowed to issue permits to facilitate construction or modification.
But in the then, going forward, they're going to be under a FIP at least for a while, right? Until their, as opposed to their SIP.
But that itself wouldn't be sufficient for standing because these rules purely inure to their benefit.
Depends on your baseline, but we've been,
right,
through,
but
we've been over that ground, yeah.
If there's no further questions, we believe the petition should be denied.
All right, thank you. All right, counsel for the state of Texas.
Thank you, Judge Rogers. A couple of cleanups and my ultimate point. Apropos of a question you and Judge Kavanaugh were pressing, the truth of the matter is that if EPA promulgates NAAQS for new pollutant, EPA, unless it in its grace decides to use the method they describe, would in fact have a construction moratorium, which demonstrates the absurdity of our position. A couple of other points about point 165. Relative to Judge Tatel questions, if Section 165 was crystal
just
clear,
on that, sorry to interrupt, but they seem to be saying that with pride, not that it was absurd.
Well, I
so
don't
how do
think.
You,
I mean, think. I hate to waste my very limited time on that, but think about their logic. They're saying if they are tightening an existing requirement in a mature program, and therefore they can see fit, not they have to, but they can see fit to come up with a surrogate, we're not going to knock the state out from its position as the proper permitting authority. But if we've got a brand new one, something like carbon that nobody has seen, in that situation they can because there's no surrogate. That's the gist of their position. A couple of other points. If Section 165 was that crystal clear as a matter of Chevron 1, then EPA's decision...
Let me just ask you, we'll give you time, but I just want to be clear about this. Following up on the point of Judge Kavanaugh's question about the state not only wants 3 years, but it might come up with a SIP that is substantively different than
the FIP. That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. And so is the argument that because of our quasi-sovereign interest, it's our decision whether we want to subject major emitting sources within our state to this moratorium?
I would say that that is a painful choice, but that is a choice for runs with being a sovereign.
That is where the state is? I just need to be clear about this.
Well, the state injury is twofold. Injury to its industrial sources, but also injury to the state's decision.
So if you have a conflict, all right, where EPA, where Texas has told us, this court, about the economic harm of a moratorium, and it also would like the 3-year period, where does that leave you?
We do not believe that the moratorium is justified by a proper harmonized reading of a statute, but you have two independent injuries. But what you're asking me a different question. Again, under EPA's logic, whenever EPA comes up with a pollutant to bring it into the PSD program for which they do not believe an existing PSD program as a surrogate, the state is thrown out. A couple of points apropos of 165. 165, Judge Taylor, was so clear when EPA's decision in Avenue was unlawful.
In what case?
It's a permitting case. EPA did not subject Avenue.
Avenue. All right.
Yes,
I just didn't
did
hear
not subject
correctly.
It to greenhouse gas related requirements on this PSD permit.
It permitted without.
Has anybody challenged the? Maybe that was illegal.
Well, it's very difficult from our perspective when EPA presses two inconsistent positions in two cases.
Well, but if we're trying to interpret this, you could tell from our questions with EPA that we're operating here, at least from their perspective, at Chevron 1.
Right.
So when we're trying to interpret the statute, if we think the statute's clear, maybe Avenol was unlawful also.
Right. And then, of course, in looking at Chevron 1, it's not just individual section. That's the point I was going to make. By the way, if EPA is wrong about Chevron 1, if Chevron 2, I'm almost embarrassed to bring it out, but the Brill versus NRB rule has to fail.
Of course it does.
Now, a couple of other points about CR, really only two. I understand how, again, you have to harmonize it with your decision in CRR. Again, in our view, we did not decide this case, but I want to respect, press the point that if you were to conclude otherwise, if you were to conclude that Section 110 is irrelevant here, you're going to vitiate a great deal of precedent, both in this circuit and in our circuits. For example, we're talking about concerned citizens of Briseburg and out of a Third Circuit that says very clearly that EPA does not have generic power to revise SIPs. It only has specific limited cabin grants of authority in Section 110. That would not apply here. We're talking about NRDC versus Brown, again, enunciated rules of construction in the context of a Clean Air Act. We look at individual section, but I also look at the structure of the act. We're talking about, frankly, about your sister circuit, decision in synergy. But very interesting, where Judge Posner, the same panel that held that the source and issue was wrong several years later in how it was pressing the point, not to get into the details, hourly versus annual emissions. The very same judge said that to the extent that EPA made a mistake in the SIP, they were stuck with the consequences of that mistake, in large part because of cooperative federalism.
We're into our second case. Let's stick to this case.
All right. As to our signed case, what I wanted to emphasize from a cooperative federalism perspective, EPA is pressing free outcomes, all of which are utterly untenable, in accordance with the principles of cooperative federalism as enunciated by the Supreme Court. Basically, a free result. So, while EPA said it very gingerly, we're not supplanting state of Texas as PSD authority. We're just filling the gap. That's shilly-shallying, Judge Rogers. the whole point about being a permitting authority in the context of a SIP, if you're operating in the context of an approved SIP, you are the permitting authority. There's no gap-filling or supplementation. So EPA basically is saying three things. Either SIPs are infinitely malleable under some form of automatic updating, which is enormously troubling from a perspective of the Constitution, because how can you have, if you look at the Medicaid portion of NFIB, how can you have pressed very clearly the point that a contract between two sovereigns cannot be illusory? I cannot have a contract with you, Judge Tato, if a contract says that it means whatever you think it means. There's no bargain involved. The one outcome is infinitely malleable SIPs. The second, have SIPs change on a dime. 21 days or 30 days. That cannot be consistent with non-coercion. And by the way, another point in FIB is no surprise. You cannot spring it on the states. And the third outcome, which we talked apropos of Judge Kavanaugh's question, is you get balance back and forth between permitting authority. Every time EPA comes in, unless they deign in their discretion to give you a surrogate approach, you are supplanted with a FIP for however long God only knows. That cannot be the right outcome, both consistent with 110 and consistent with cooperative federalism.
I think we have your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the state of Wyoming, if you wish any rebuttal. No, no rebuttal. And counsel for the Utility Air Regulatory Group.
Thank you. I have three quick points. First on standing, as Judge Kavanaugh indicated, and I believe you agreed, we claim that the statute isn't self-executing. We also say that the 166 regulation applies, and if the 166 regulation applies, the states have 3 years to adopt a SIP that would be applied prospectively. So during that 3-year period, PSD permits could continue to issue under the for conventional pollutants and not GHGs. If we are correct in the merits of our positions, then we have suffered injury by what EPA has done, and that injury will be redressed. Second, and this goes to the correctness of interpreting Section 165 as being self-executing. If it's self-executing, if states are required to kind of update their SIPs in accordance with, by virtue of Section 165, and if their SIPs don't include what 165 requires, then they must their power to authorize construction terminates until the SIP is revised. What 165 would prohibit is the construction of any facility that emitted over 250 tons of greenhouse gases. Now, the tailoring rule makes clear that sources emitting 100 to 250 tons of greenhouse gases are not subject to the PSD program. And they could not be subject to the PSD program. They could not be a part of an implementation plan. An implementation plan is defined in 302Q to be the plan, most recent revision thereof, which is approved by the administrator and which implements the requirement of the Act. The requirement with respect to GHGs is a requirement that applies at the lowest 75,000 tons carbon equivalent. So that the automatic triggering is something that bears no relationship to what the PSD requirement is that states must include in their SIP. The final point I would make is that if that interpretation is correct, then every 40 CFR 166 change potentially triggers a construction moratorium. I know Judge Tatel and Judge Rogers have participated in earlier cases dealing with the requirements of the modification rules, all of which go to the heart of what permits are required under Section 165. Every time new requirements are established, that deal with the fundamental requirements of the Act, you create a construction moratorium. That runs counter to the entire history. Final point.
Can I ask one other question? Sure. You were talking about the reality on the ground,
mm-hmm.
Where EPA has issued this, what I would call, gap-filling FIP, and the notion that the state could come up with a SIP that has very different requirements. What are we dealing with here?
In my view, Your Honor, there is very little room for different requirements with respect to GHGs.
Right, it's just backed, right? That's it.
Well,
you
yes.
Install back, and backed is 10%. I mean, we know what it is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah right. Right.
The EPA has had a very difficult time coming out with permits.
Yes, I realize that.
And it's had a difficult time because this is a brand new regulatory
right.
program.
Okay, yeah. I just wanted to be clear about that.
Okay, and,
right.
and
you had
so
a final point.
The final point is the surrogate total suspended particulate for PM10, the standard, the particulate standard, was total suspended particulate. EPA allowed the program to move forward with total suspended particulates, even though the new PM standard was PM10, so that EPA did not impose a construction moratorium, nor should EPA have done so.
Did it rely on this regulation?
Rely on 166A6. The agency did not address it in that context, and I believe this came before that regulation. I think that the rule at that time was a 9 months rule.
Yes, it was a differently phrased rule,
right,
because it had a 9 month rather than 3 years. But
and I don't think
I
it had.
I thought it might have. I don't know.
The other thing is that it didn't have the provision that said that the SIPs may be applied prospectively upon the date of approval.
All
thank
right,
you very
thank
much.
You. We'll take the case under advisement.